Hello and welcome to Energy Unplugged by Aurora. This podcast features various experts from Aurora having in-depth conversations with key industry leaders, policymakers, and academics from all over the world. It explores the hottest topics across the energy market and gives a unique perspective on major energy issues.
Welcome to Energy Unplugged. I'm Hugo Batten, Managing Director of Aurora across APAC. We're delighted to be joined by today's guest, Craig Francis, CEO of Genex Power. Genex is the only listed pure-play renewable energy generation and storage company listed on the Australian Stock Exchange. The company is also developing a major 250-megawatt long-duration pump storage project in North Queensland, as well as a portfolio of other assets that we'll get to. Craig's had a distinguished career, both in energy and in banking and corporate finance. This conversation will largely focus on renewable and storage development in the Australian market. Craig, welcome to Energy Unplugged. Delighted you can join us.
Thanks very much for having me, Hugo, and Aurora team.
We're also joined today by James Ha, Aurora's research lead for APAC. Welcome, James.
Thanks, Hugo. Good to be back.
To kick it off, James, do you maybe want to lead the conversation just on the broad topic of pumped hydro in Australia?
Yeah, definitely. And it has been a big topic in recent years, and that's largely driven in Australia by competing views over Snowy Hydro 2.0, which is a huge 2-gigawatt project that's being built by the federal government. We mentioned in the intro that Genex is building its own pumped hydro project. So Craig, it would be great if you could walk us through some of the challenges associated with actually delivering a new pumped hydro asset in a market like the NEM. And perhaps we can split those challenges into two categories. So one, the cost-related issues, so things related to construction, grid connection, supply chains, particularly for a technology like pumped hydro that hasn't seen too much activity in Australia in recent years. And then the challenges on the revenue side around offtake, you know, managing volatility and revenues, grid constraints, those sorts of things.
Sure, James, happy to dive into it. But maybe, look, I'll start by giving the listeners a little bit of context for what we're doing at Kidston, which is where we're developing our flagship pumped storage hydro project. It's actually in an old abandoned gold mine with two big open pits. So it's a pretty unique and innovative project, and we think quite exciting in that regard. But also, it came with a lot of existing infrastructure. It came with 1.5 reservoirs. It came with very close proximity between the two reservoirs, and very well known geology. It had access to water through the old mine operation. It's got a construction camp. It's got an airstrip. The one shortcoming it did have, however, was it did not have a high voltage transmission connection. It did have power supply, which is great, but sadly only enough to export 50 megawatts of solar. And look, I think most pumped hydro projects have, you know, a lot of attributes, right, that are necessary to develop these schemes, you know, that relies a lot on the natural topography of the land and on the location and other sort of existing infrastructure there. But certainly they all have at least one shortcoming, and ours was certainly in grid, which was the major challenge for us in getting Kidston off the ground. That being said, we're really pleased in May 2021 to get the project to financial close, and it's been in construction ever since, and it's now entering its final year, all going pretty well, on track to be energized by the end of this calendar year, and it will be delivering first revenues in the first half of 2025 calendar year. So been a long journey for Genex. We started this journey in 2015, and really pleasing. It will be next year anyway when we press the button.
But on the construction side, that's a pretty quick turnaround, Craig, compared to the Snowy 2.0 project. But you know, now first target for electricity is the end of this decade, and you know, there's something like 20 kilometers of tunneling to do. It sounds like this project is a bit more conceptually simple, helped out by the mines that you guys have inherited for this project.
Absolutely, yeah. And being located on an old gold mine, you know, the environmental issues and things are much more readily contained than, you know, large spans of national park, which is clearly a big challenge for that particular project. But look, they're very different. You know, they've got the same technology, reversible pump turbines. But otherwise, they're very different in terms of, you know, the concepts and the challenges that they face. But happy to sort of dive into some of the issues that we faced in getting the project committed, which was a really big milestone for us, you know, 6 years in the making from when it was first conceived as GenX. Really around the construction, we managed to deliver the project with a fixed price lump sum EPC contract, which was a great result with some high quality contractors in John Holland and McConnell Dow. That really gave us a lot of certainty to underpin the project financing. I think the construction industry is obviously under some pressure at the moment with the general escalation in the economy, supply chain issues and other things. You know, whether that sort of model will continue for the future, it probably remains to be seen. But certainly for us, it was a really big factor in being able to then secure the project finance against a construction contract to build the project. The other key issue, which I mentioned before, was grid, and not so much in the complexity of the grid connection. It's, you know, the beauty of Pantaggio, it's spinning chunks of metal. So it's really great. You know, the network's trying to encourage more of these onto the network to give system strength and other network support services. But in the grid connection itself, and Kirsten being remote, where we've been required to deliver or commission a new 186-kilometer transmission line from Kidston to the main network backbone on the transmission network between Cairns and Townsville. And that itself was a big challenge. The project has funded a substantial proportion of that in its project CapEx, but it wouldn't have been possible without the support of the Queensland government, who stepped in with $147 million line of funding via Powerlink to deliver that infrastructure. And really, the concept behind it is, and I'm sure we'll talk more about this further in the discussion, but really Kidston is becoming, you know, the first mini res in the NEM. It's got, you know, government sort of contributed to the CapEx funding.
Maybe we can just explain for our non-Australian listeners, by res here, we're talking about renewable energy zones, which is basically the way that Australia is thinking about developing its renewable resources. Instead of just letting anyone connect anywhere, we're trying to locate them, given the need to develop scale-efficient infrastructure like transmission to these dedicated places. Anyway, sorry, Craig, interrupted you.
Thanks for clarifying, James. You've got to remember we have a global audience here, so some of these terms are a little bit foreign. But look, that was a key piece. The Queensland co-funding that transmission infrastructure enabled that to happen. It has spare capacity, which means that we'll be able to connect to other technologies at Kidston in the future. But Kidston is the anchor tenant, and really that was the final piece of the puzzle to get the project finance from the sort of the construction component perspective.
Awesome. So that's the cost side. Craig, could you also speak to the difficulties on the revenue side?
Yeah, very happy to, James. Essentially, these projects, they're very capital intensive. And for that reason, you know, the optimal funding structure involves using leverage project finance, and as is quite common across the renewable energy generation market and the storage market as well. The banks really like certainty of revenue and don't really like to take market risk. That certainly becomes more complex when you've got a largely arbitrage driven revenue model where you're really looking at your cost curve, the price at which you pump water uphill and charge the water battery, if you like, and the price at which you discharge in the evenings. I think that became a big hurdle for banks when looking at the revenue model, you know, juggling two revenue curves essentially, or two price curves. So the key for us was to mitigate that, take that risk out of the structure to give the bank certainty to get the debt that we needed to deliver the project. And the way we've been able to do that at Kidston is through a long-term 30-year arrangement with Energy Australia, which is one of the big utilities here in Australia, one of the big three. On a full dispatch rights contract basis. So essentially they pay us to lease the plant over the long term. They'll operate it, they'll take the full P&L risk, MLF risk, and all other sort of risks associated with the operation of the project, and pay us a fixed annual fee. And while that might not be that exciting for equity returns and outperformance, it's certainly a very attractive revenue profile for the banks, and also for you know, equity certainty of return as well. So piecing that together was a big process in itself, something we finally confirmed in 2020, a year before financial close in 2021. But look, I think I think that market has evolved a little bit. I think you're going to market these days, certainly if we were going to market with kids, Jen, I think we would have a lot more interest than we did back in 2018 when we started the process. And really, you know, storage was just becoming part of the conversation. I think these days, if anyone had a shovel-ready pumped hydro project, you'd be finding it much simpler to find a counterparty to take that longer-term market risk because of the emerging dynamics in the market and the blatant need for this long-duration storage to underpin retail portfolios.
Craig, it's almost worth just spending 1 minute on that for listeners, particularly in Queensland. Australia's this very long thing, grid and Queensland's at the end. And there's basically been, trying to get out of coal, so the need for firm dispatchable capacity. But arguably even more fundamentally than that, this huge emergence, particularly rooftop solar, but also grid scale solar. And so now there's a very extreme duck curve in Queensland where prices are often negative in the middle of the day and for quite long parts of the middle of the day. And then there's quite a steep ramp to meet evening peaks. So that's the incentive for Energy Australia. And that arbitrage opportunity has been pretty persistent in Queensland for the last 3 or 4 years, as you say.
Absolutely. I think that's a big piece of the puzzle in Queensland is moving this daytime solar, this excess daylight, so daytime solar that's feeding into the system from, as you say, rooftops and large scale, putting downward pressure on pricing. It's moving that into the evenings where the Queensland market becomes very tight. In the summer peak period, there's sort of available excess capacity of a few hundred megawatts, which is not a comfortable position for any market operator to be in. So certainly that's what this pump storage is able to do, more so than batteries, because it can shift larger volumes for larger durations, which batteries obviously operate in the shorter duration space.
Craig, maybe we can zoom out a little from pumped hydro to storage in general, because in addition to developing Kidston, Genex has also developed the Baldacombe battery, which managed to secure a loan from a private fund manager in Australia called InfraDebt. Do you think that project finance is becoming more comfortable with storage assets in general, or specifically with batteries? And does that kind of affect the technology types that Genex might look to pursue in future when it's trying to build out its storage portfolio?
Well, Baldacombe is a very interesting part of our portfolio. We brought it online. It's a 50 megawatt 2-hour battery, which came online at full capacity in December of last year and has been operating ever since, which is great timing ahead of, we've seen some pretty peaky pricing in Queensland since that time. I guess we approached that project, batteries have been around for some time in Australia, and certainly banks have looked at them. However, we adopted a very deliberate model for the revenue of Baldacombe. We really, after giving away, all that P&L exposure to Energy Australia and, having done a lot of work on it and really understanding the upside, we really wanted to capture some of that for ourselves. So we took that approach to this battery. And we're able to manage an offtake contract with Tesla to operate the battery, which is quite unique in itself. It enables us to get a revenue floor, which supports that level of project finance that you mentioned, but then gives us an upside exposure, which we share. So essentially, they guarantee a minimum level of revenue, whatever the battery earns. If it's in excess of that, we share the excess amount with Tesla in accordance with a fixed ratio. For us, that gives downside protection, which is great for the banks. We've got $35 million or 65% gearing in that structure. But it gives us good exposure to the upside, which is something we think is really valuable and something that should be quite profitable for us and our shareholders over the medium term. So, that was a very deliberate approach for us. I think it was the first project finance battery with merchant exposure in the market. But we've since seen, as you say, the market is catching up. And we are seeing certainly banks, InfraDebt is the specialist debt fund with an interest in specifically in batteries, but we are seeing more conventional banks start to play in this space and become a bit more flexible, a bit more understanding of the arbitrage business case and the fact that you've got a curve to charge, a price curve to charge and a price curve to generate, and that they can be largely predictable and forecast with good accuracy. So certainly there's becoming more appetite, which I think is a great thing for the industry. It's going to be a great thing for bringing more battery capacity on. It's going to take away the need for someone else to take all of the market risk off the table for a battery to be committed to financial close and into construction. So certainly there's a lot of progress, and we're looking forward to being part of further progress.
Yeah, awesome. We do see that interest, particularly in Australia. I think the most well-attended of our group meetings, which is like a little conference we put on every quarter, the most well-attended from last year was the one on financing merchant batteries, really well-attended by developers, but also project finance. And it does seem like it's the hot topic at the moment.
Craig, maybe if we could talk a little bit, you know, we talked about pumped hydro and storage, talk a little bit about GenX and the strategy. So, you know, as you've discussed, pumped hydro, clearly a core part of the portfolio, but you're also developing and have operational solar, wind and battery assets and clearly thinking about different offtake structures and exposures. I think people talk in general about portfolios and diversification, but how did GenX think about developing its portfolio? And obviously there's a balance here between opportunistic sites and then, you know, more sophisticated analysis of diversification against price curves. Like what was the strategy there, I suppose?
Yeah, and maybe for the listeners, you know, GenX's portfolio today, we talk about 400 megawatts we have committed. That encompasses three operational assets: a 50 megawatt solar farm in North Queensland, operating since 2017; 50 megawatt solar farm in New South Wales, operating since 2021; and our battery, which we just spoke about, which has been operating since late last year. In addition to the pumped hydro, which is up under construction, energizing later this year, and first revenues next year. And really, look, that portfolio started at zero back in 2015 when we listed on the stock exchange here, and has evolved over time, as you say, I think more through opportunity than you know, strategic planning and analysis. You know, we certainly looked at the jurisdictions and the technologies in each jurisdiction and what was most attractive and what was going to generate the best economic returns, absolutely. But you know, I think that's it's evolved more naturally. You know, we have the relationships in Queensland, the knowledge from all the work we did in the pumped hydro to do a battery, and similarly, we saw an opportunity in New South Wales with elevated solar pricing to really leverage the offtake structure at Kidston to do a portfolio financing to commission Gemalong into operation. So, I think going ahead, though, we really have been adopting a model more of offtake led delivery rather than developing projects to then go to market and try and contract them, really being led by where the demand is and what technologies are in demand in what jurisdictions and how best to deliver those. And you know, the case in point there is Bully Creek in southern Queensland, which we acquired in the middle of 2022, initially with the plans to develop our next battery hot off the heels of Baldacombe, but we were really surprised and inundated by the demand for solar PPAs at the time, and you know, pretty active in a couple of processes, which turned our attention more towards focusing on the large scale solar development at that site, which is fit for purpose for both solar and BESS. So we took the decision in October of last year. We signed our first PPA on that project, a 25-year deal with Fortescue, to prioritize the solar over the BESS, so that we're taking the solar to FID this year, and the BESS will be a 2025 financing decision. So really that's the model that we're looking to employ. We think diversification is good, both in terms of technology, also jurisdiction, and also, you know, revenue structures as well. And we typically, when we look at merchant risk, we think there's certainly a place for that in our portfolio, but we also want to maintain a highly contracted portfolio. That's what's attractive for our shareholders and you know, most of the investors in the industry. So trying to get that blend where we get some good merchant exposure where we think it makes sense. It also provides a degree of diversification in the revenue structure, but maintaining a highly contracted portfolio is another thing that we look at.
And, you know, listeners should have picked up on this, I think, by now, but renewable and storage development in Australia is not a very easy game. You know, there are a number of challenges, from grid to financing to offtake to some of the technology and supply chain issues. And, you know, it's quite competitive in Australia as well. So, you know, we hear a lot of client discussing margin compression and those kinds of things. When you look at successful players in Australia, like people who've actually delivered real assets and real portfolios, including yourself, obviously, do you see kind of common threads in terms of capabilities of those teams? Like, you know, when you look at your competitor suite, what are the kind of things you're looking at that you think are markers of long-term success in this market?
It's a good question, Shigo. I mean, the market is growing in terms of the number of parties out there that are looking to develop capacity. Mm. I think it's great. I think, you know, we have this energy transition underway. It needs to accelerate. And without everyone, you know, rowing in the same direction, we're not going to get there. So I think it's really good to see. I guess, you know, what do I think is important when participating in this sector? You know, I think establishing a track record of getting things done is really valuable. There's a lot of parties out there with a lot of announcements and you know, talking big projects and big ambitions. But I think there is really, you know, a lot of value to be placed in those that are delivering, and certainly, you know, a lot of respect for those that are just getting on with it and delivering capacity and focusing on the next one and just continuing to support the transition. I think the other thing that we all need to be conscious of as a industry, and I think what makes certain developers more successful over others is bringing the community along with us in this journey. Mm. These projects, you know, no one's building it on land that they own. It all always interacts with landowners, with communities, with Indigenous owners, and just coming in there and you know, developing capacity without consultation and without bringing them on the journey and compensating them adequately, I think does give parts of the industry you know, a bit of a bad name. So I think it's on all of us really to take the community with us and be good corporate citizens. It might cost us a little bit more maybe take a bit more time, but I think it's important for the transition and for the you know, the long-term development of this industry.
Yeah, completely agree. I'm not sure if braggawatts is an Australian term or a marginal term, but as you say, there are certainly a lot of braggawatts in the Australian market, but at the same time, there's a core group of developers who have a great track record and are consistently delivering sizable projects. James, do you maybe want to talk a little bit about the policy and market framework?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, you know, we just talked about deliverability versus announcements. I mean, one of the biggest sources of announcements in Australia over the last year or so has actually come from governments themselves, particularly in Queensland, you know, where some of the projects that GenX is developing is. The Queensland state government, you know, announced its energy and jobs plan a little bit over a year ago. Which is a huge policy designed to retire the state-owned coal by the middle of next decade, but also bring online a lot of dispatchable capacity. So Queensland government's talked about building 7 gigawatts of 24-hour duration pumped hydro. And then more recently, the federal government has announced its capacity investment scheme, which is looking to support about 9 gigawatts of dispatchable capacity. How do these recent announcements affect the way GenX is thinking about future investments? And does it appear more as a source of competition for you guys or more as a series of auctions and tenders that you might look to participate in yourselves?
Yeah, there is a lot of new policy coming into play, that's for sure, James. And look, I think... certainly since the last federal election, we've seen a real tailwind start to blow behind this industry with the alignment of federal and state governments almost across the board in terms of their predisposure to this sector and you know, the deployment of renewable energy to displace the thermal plant. And that's been really encouraging for us. I think you don't sort of see it in action, but you sort of feel it when engaging with the market, and there's a lot more sort of an upbeat nature to all the counterparties that we speak to. And I think that's really been driven by having political alignment across the board. And hopefully that's now sort of here to stay. We're not going to return to the years of the climate wars and where things became a little bit more challenging. That being said, I think really as industry, you know, there are a lot of new policies. Sometimes it is hard to keep up, but really what we need is just policy stability and certainty. I think new announcements, yeah. You know, while they are intended to really fast track renewable energy rollout and accelerate the transition and provide support for parties like GenX and other developers. Often at times, the constant wave of new announcements and new policies can be disruptive. It can change, the views of some of our counterparties and how they're looking to contract or develop capacity. And I think really what is the tailwinds are welcome, the initiatives welcome, but I think stability is really the key going forward. I think that's really what the industry is looking for, to just get on with it and deliver that capacity. And I'm sure we will. It was a quiet year last year, but I think 2024 we're going to see a huge amount of capacity added to the grid.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point, Craig. And people often talk about the energy trilemma, right? Decarbonization, reliability, cost. But I think underpinning that is this point around stability and coherence, that it is very difficult to make long-term investment in assets when there's like dramatic policy shifts happening all the time. And I think it's the nature of Australia's federalism. There's just a lot of cooks in the kitchen as well. And, markets like the UK don't quite have to deal with that in the same way. So I think that's a really important point. I mean, I suppose, the final question on policy, where do you see the NEM going from here, right? Because the NEM was a construct of the 90s when it was about getting efficiency out of existing thermal assets. And Australia was very proud of its 5-minute settlement, wholesale-only market with a liquid contracts market to augment that wholesale-only market. But it does feel like that's, a little bit on the ropes, in the sense that there are things like the capacity investment scheme, which is, a form of capacity market. And that's a trend globally as well, right? I mean, I think I saw an article the other day that even Germany is talking about instigating a capacity market. Texas is shifting from wholesale-only. Like, where does the NEM... what does the NEM look like, I suppose, in 10 years' time? Is it basically the same as today with some ad hoc things to get us through the transition, or does it look fundamentally different, do you think?
Look, that's another good question, Shigo. I guess I've just made a plea for stability. Shift in the policy framework would, we'd of course deal with them. But, I think... yeah, yes, there are initiatives announced, right? And they are going to have changes to the way the NEM operates, but I think we're still going to have the same, hopefully, framework where we've got a spot market that gets traded every 5 minutes and settled. And really, we have in the past relied upon the price signals sent by those markets to make our investment decisions and doing long-term modeling based on those to underpin them. Yeah, as to what impact the capacity investment scheme will have, I mean, we still get to see all the detail behind that and how that's going to flow through, whether that will deliver the energy transition in full or whether it will supplement the rest of the activity that's going on, probably still remains to be seen. I think a wholesale market that's traded every 5 minutes, I hope that's still here within the next decade. And hopefully, we now have the policy settings that we're going to move forward with, and we're not going to see too many changes from here. Well, that being said, I think certainly, and going back to Kidston and talking about RESs, these renewable energy zones, where we're trying to coordinate generation and transmission in single location and make it more, use it efficiently rather than ad hoc connections of projects up and down the east coast of Australia. I think it's a really great initiative, and certainly it's got similarities to what we managed to achieve at Kidston, where we had to have basically an anchor tenant of a new piece of transmission infrastructure, and we're now working to fill the balance of that. I think it's a great initiative. I think it's obviously highly complex to try and coordinate gigawatts of generation capacity with the private sector, to align with the delivery of transmission infrastructure. But longer term, I think it will get executed, and I think it will enable us to really make the most efficient use of the transmission infrastructure that we have, and obviously try and keep costs down. So I think that is a great initiative that should help create longer term efficiencies.
Yeah, and I hear you on that one. Some kind of pragmatic central coordination around RESs just looks like it's an increasing feature of the Australian system, but also other markets like the RES concept, for example, has gone to Philippines. It's gone elsewhere. and hear you as well on the wholesale market. I mean, I do think that the crisis of Europe, in some ways, you know, government's made some pretty dramatic interventions in wholesale markets, but it also showed the resilience of wholesale markets in some way, in that they weren't scrapped. You know, caps were put in, adjustments were made, but wholesale markets persisted. So I think that's a positive. Maybe a couple of slightly more rapid fire wrap-up questions. And we try to ask, or James and I try to ask these in most of these sessions. What's an out-of-consensus view you have on the energy transition that you think is at odds, you know, mild odds with the rest of Australia's energy community, perhaps?
Yeah, I might stick to what I, my bread and butter, what I know, and that's around pumped storage hydro and the feasibility of these projects. I think there, you know, there's an expectation that pumped hydro is going to be delivered at a very efficient cost, you know, pretty rapidly over the next decade. And our experience tells us that, and also, you know, the other project being built in Snowy, it tells you that they have a very long lead time in terms of feasibility. There are a number of technical challenges that need to be sorted before you can even put a shovel in the ground. The construction timeframes are very long, and they have their challenges. And I think that technology will get delivered, but I think it's going to come later than everyone expects. And look, therein is that's a challenge for us to step up and deliver. And certainly, as GenX, you know, we're recipients of public money for our project. We are trying to play our part and share learnings and knowledge from our project to try and circumvent some of those challenges and make sure that you know, the industry grows collectively. But certainly, you know, I think that the challenge is on all of us to try and deliver that capacity imminently. And if we don't, there's going to be certainly price signals and probably the prolonged life of some of the thermal plant.
Yep, absolutely. And then a final one. Who do you read or listen to in the energy space that you think is always good, thought-provoking, and relevant to your work in the private sector as well?
That's another good question, Hugo. I've got a family of three young children, and my time for leisure reading is very limited. I often get most of my news from LinkedIn. So I don't think I can offer any advice other than, of course, the Energy Unplugged podcast is a fantastic and thought-provoking publication.
I'm with you. I've got two young kids as well, and it's depressing how little I know about the outside world that is not featured on LinkedIn at the moment. I very much hear you on that. Craig, thank you so much for your time. We've covered a lot there. We're very appreciative. And thank you for coming on and talking about pumped hydro and GenX in particular. It's been terrific.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And James, thank you as well.
Thanks, Hugo.
That was Craig Francis, CEO of GenX Power, talking to Hugo Batten, Managing Director for Aurora across APAC, and James Haar, Research Lead for APAC. Do keep an eye on our podcast feed for more in-depth conversations with senior members of the energy industry. The best way to do this is to subscribe on whatever platform you use. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.